View of the North, a look at perspectives on wealth and poverty from the perspective of the wealthy or the comfortable or the affluent in global terms. This morning I'm going to try to take us through a view from the South or a look at the South, using those terms North and South as shorthand ways of saying the rich and the poor, or the industrialized North and the non-industrialized South of the world. I'd like to do three things, talking primarily about development, which is a slippery word. It has a variety of meanings to a variety of people. No single definition that I've ever found is satisfying to very many people, but everybody uses it. We talk about the underdeveloped nations or the developing nations, which is a more euphemistic way of saying it, I guess. It is from the perspective of the developed, whoever they are, presumably we. Some say today that we are overdeveloped and what we need is de-development to back up from our kind of development, which is overdone or wrongly done. We got a little on that last evening when we looked at alternate ways of growing food, producing crops and fish, alternate uses of or alternate forms of energy, etc. That's all de-development in a way. So one of the things I want to do is talk about varying definitions of development as they have evolved, particularly in the last 30 years. But that's part two. Part one is some of the theories about the reasons for the poverty of the South. And we can just dip into that very briefly. And we'll pick it up again tomorrow morning. But I want to look first at some of the reasons for the poverty of the South. Secondly, what kind of development are we after, or is the world seeking, or are the poor nations pursuing? And then thirdly, what are some ways of measuring progress? Can you ever tell if things are better than they were? Is there a quantifiable way of measuring that? And comparing between nations and between times, between 1950 and 1978 in, let's say, Brazil. There are some tools that have been devised rather recently, and that'll be part three. How do you measure whether in fact there is any progress? But let me back up first and say something about the reality of poverty in the world. We forget oftentimes that the standard life experience of most human beings throughout most of history has been poverty. At least from the perspective of our position today, it has been poverty. It has been subsistence, survival, existence that most people have, if we can use the word, enjoyed or sought. That kind of minimal level has been also the maximum for the great majority of people. There have always been people of great wealth. But the vast majority, 95 to 99% of most people in most times, in most societies, have been what we would call today impoverished, just barely making it. So that the situation of the poor in the South of today's world is not all that unusual, historically viewed. That's the way it's always been. What is unusual is the takeoff, the development, the rise to a very high standard of living of the last approximately 200 years of the North Atlantic, which has now been extended to Japan, Australia, New Zealand, which are really part of the North Atlantic community in that they are European settled, not Japan, but Australia and New Zealand. That is what is unusual. So then you say, okay, are the poor any worse off today than they were before? Well, probably in one way of looking at it, no, they aren't. There are those who contend, and Michael Harrington is one of them, and we'll look at that in more detail tomorrow, that in fact the enrichment of the rich comes at the expense of the poor, the impoverishment of the poor, at least in some degree, is a result of the enrichment of the rich. And he points to the colonial era of exploitation of resources of the poor, and there is some basis for that case, I think. But I think more important even than that is the fact that the poor today know how the rich live. And so in relative terms, the poor, whether they're in the U.S. society or within West Germany or within the Indian tribes of Latin America. Even they know today, because of communication systems, that there is another way of life, and that there are people who don't have to have a daily worry about food, shelter, health care, and so on. The poor know how the rich live, and so in relative terms, the poor feel somehow left out, deprived, underdeveloped when they look at what might be. So I think there are two ways of talking about the poor being worse off than before. There is a case that can be made that the mass of the Indian people today are worse off than before the British occupation, because of what the British occupation of India did to their cottage industries, the trade patterns that were created to extract raw materials from India but not allow Indians to make processed goods. Those kinds of things we'll discuss tomorrow. But probably more significant than that is the awareness that the poor have of how the rich live, and that there is, in fact, a rich world, and an increasing resentment about the use of resources disproportionately by the rich world. And whether it's true or not, many of the poor believe that the rich are exploiting them through the international systems. Well, that's one way, that's one set of reasons that are being talked about for the impoverishment or continuing gap between rich and poor, the growing gap. The other set of reasons are internal to the poor. And I want to pick that up briefly this morning. The external reasons, the North's domination of the South's resources and the international system controlled by the North, we'll look at tomorrow. The internal factors have to do with attitudes, worldviews in the traditional societies of the Third World, basically Asia, Africa, Latin America, that are different, strikingly different, from the worldview of those areas influenced by the Western ideas. And this author, Piero Ghedo, a Roman Catholic priest who is Italian, believes that that can be traced back directly to the Judeo-Christian revelation. Now, I don't agree with everything in this book, but I find it intriguing, his thesis, which I'm going to say a little more about, that it goes back to a view of history, predominantly a view of history which is different in Judeo-Christian and some would add Muslim thought, the monotheism of the West, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, but primarily the Jewish and Christian scriptures as the basis, that history is viewed there as linear advance. And both of those words are important. It is progressive and it is linear. It is not cyclical, constant repetition of the same thing ad infinitum, nor is history a fatalistic trap. And Ghedo contends that in most of the traditional societies of the South, that's how history has been understood. In the West, the Judeo-Christian West, even in its secularized version, it still has roots in that biblical witness, progress or change is possible. There's a concept of the intervention of God into history and a divine-human partnership, working it out together to change things. The idea of change is possible and positive. Related to this is the understanding of nature, which Western humanity has had. Basically, an attitude of mastery over nature, subduing it, controlling it, turning it to human purposes, which has had some destructive results that we're increasingly aware of. Thirdly, the growth of scientific technology, tools for modern agriculture and industrial production, the harnessing of fossil fuels. Ghedo says, at least in his mind, that can all be traced back to the understanding of history and of nature, which Western humanity has had, and he attributes that to the revelation. Now, in contrast, the Third World cultures traditionally have had very different views of man, of nature, of work, of family, and of community. And Ghedo would not say, nor would I, that those are bad, that those are negative. They are simply different. They have had different consequences. Let me quote one quotation which Geddo shares on work. Many white people who travel around Africa say, the blacks do not want to work. This is not true. It is not that they do not want to work, only that they have a different idea of work. They do not have a drive to work, a compulsion to work. They do not share the work ethic, which we talked about yesterday. It is not because of laziness, however. They do not live in a money economy, so it is not possible for them to save. Work is considered only as a means of survival, of subsistence, not as a way of controlling nature and improving one's standard of life in the future. And then he reports this incident. A few years ago, a young enterprising missionary sent home to Europe for some plows with metal plowshares to be used for increasing the rice harvest. This was somewhere in Africa, southern Africa. And then he taught the peasants how to use them. Though plowing was not done without fatigue, because the oxen were not accustomed to so much effort, the harvest was good, and the quantity of rice was doubled. But when it came time for the second sowing of the year, the missionary was amazed to see no one working in the rice fields. "Why is nothing being done?" he asked. "Are you going to allow your rice fields to remain uncultivated?" Traditionally, they were able to plant two crops per season there, and they always did that before because they needed it. But now they'd already had a doubled harvest from the first crop. The answer was simple. "We have harvested enough rice for a whole year. Why work anymore? But do not be troubled. Next year we shall sow rice again." A different attitude toward work and the purpose of work. Not laziness, but perfectly logical, given the situation. Not all, at the same time, has been positive about the kind of development we've had in the North. And I think we're aware of that. We don't have to elaborate and detail it. The destruction of the environment, the drive to acquisitiveness, which has, I think, become a curse, not a blessing, after you have enough. We can't agree on what is enough. Many say that we are materially rich in the North, but spiritually poor, whereas the Third World has had a great richness of spirituality, not even talking about material and spiritual so much as talking about a wholeness, a unity to life. The idea of secularization is distinctly Western. It's hardly known in traditional societies. I mean, you have to explain what you mean, and they still don't understand, because life is a unity, a wholeness. It is integrated. It is not spiritual and material. It is the whole person. And all of it is both material and spiritual, more often, more likely. So, should the Third World develop as the West has developed? Most people today say no. That would be to compound the mistakes of the Northern Hemisphere. Let me share from Geddo on that point. "Therefore, we face this paradoxical situation. On one side, Western civilization and modern progress are derived from the Christian ideas of the dignity of man and the equality of all men and the intervention of God in human history, thus effecting undeniable progress in our concepts and models of life. There is danger that the people of the Third World, blindly following the models of development of the West, will end by betraying, as did the West, the spiritual values inherited from the past." And then he writes, "If we accept the hypothesis illustrated in the preceding chapter that the dynamic culture of the Western people comes from no racial superiority over others, but from the revolution of ideas generated by the biblical Christian message that there was an eruption of God in the history of men, then we see that the search, to explain why, the difference, the search ends in a non-ethnic way, a non-racist conclusion. Today it cannot be denied that the Third World is being westernized. And this seems to be a positive fact in the sense that soon every culture will be penetrated by the revolution of ideas that historically was embodied in the West. Not because of Western genius, but because of the Word of God that penetrated and transformed the West's culture. However, and this is the big but, the Westernization of the Third World is not a positive but a negative fact if by Westernization is meant that other peoples should imitate the materialistic pattern of the West and our inhuman ways of organizing society. For example, both liberal capitalism and Marxism. In his judgment, both of those are inhuman ways of organizing society, to say nothing of the various kinds of Western fascism and racism. So he is not wholeheartedly for Westernization as it has developed, and yet he believes that the positive things that have resulted from Western development can be traced back to the biblical revelation. Well, we can debate that a little bit, I think. There are those who disagree. Part two, evolving definitions of development. What do people mean today when they talk about development? I wonder if any of you can recall how many nations, independent political nation states, there were in the world at the time of the signing of the UN Charter in 1945, San Francisco. Anybody remember or make a guess?
Less than 100.
Yes, much less than 100. There were 50, I think 50 even, and even 50 nations. Since then have been added how many independent nation states? How many are there today? No, it's about 150. So we have added double the number of independent political entities that we had in 1945, in a little over 30 years. There are something over 150 today, almost all of which are members of the UN. Well, all of those new nations thought that with political independence would also come some kind of economic independence and development, that the exploitation of their people by the colonizing powers would be over, and that some kind of development, improvement of the material lot of their people would begin to happen. In some cases it has happened. In the great majority of cases there has been disappointment, disillusionment, for a variety of reasons. Well, where were we in the 1950s, the late 40s and 50s, as the new nations started to emerge? Almost the sole definition of development that was being used then was economic growth. That definition was dominant in the first decade following World War II. I've got three of these if you want to sense my outline. Three differing definitions of development that have historically evolved. This meant that economic growth was the basic measure of whether development was happening in a society. And you measured that by measuring changes in per capita gross national product, the sum of goods and services provided through the marketplace, everything you could count, which did not include the efforts of subsistence farmers, just as it doesn't in the United States include the efforts of housewives who aren't paid. You don't count that as part of the GNP because it isn't in the marketplace, okay? But everything you could measure through the marketplace goes into GNP, and if that increased per capita, taking the total of a country's product, dividing it by the number of persons, if that went up, then you thought you were improving. You had economic growth. Well, that's a rather raw meat cleaver kind of approach to whether the typical resident of that country is any better off. The basic element in this understanding of development was trained people committed to economic growth, to helping the pie get bigger. Many advisors came from high-income countries to tell low-income countries that they should abolish ignorance, develop honesty and punctuality as those were understood in Western countries, in effect start to define work the way we define it, rather than the way it was defined in the little incident I read, and become efficient. That too is a Western definition. In other words, to become developed, Western or poor nations should follow the Western model. Well, we've gotten somewhat more sophisticated than that, and a second stage of definition of development evolved around the late 50s and into the 60s, where it was economic growth plus social change. Not economic growth alone, but economic growth coupled with social change. Non-economic factors were important, such goals as land reform, educational reform. System changes within the low-income countries were elevated as part of the development design. But the measurements of development remain basically the same. Economic indicators such as per capita dollars spent, calories consumed, electricity generated, those kinds of indices. Well, since the late 60s, approximately, a new emphasis has been emerging. Development cannot be predefined for the entire planet, the same everywhere, but must be related to a given society's overall philosophy of what the desirable life and the ideal civilization may be for it. In this definition, westernization in economic and political institutions is desirable only to the degree it accords with the values held by a given society. If it fits the values of that society, use it, fine. But don't borrow it just because it is Western. An example I'm going to use is Tanzania, partly because it has attempted to go a different way than either traditional Marxist or Western capitalist societies, and also because there's a great deal of writing about its dream, its vision, which is available and which is familiar. And much of this comes from the Arusha Declaration, which is the constitution, the call to action of the Tanzanian development concept. Under the strong leadership of philosopher-politician Julius Nyerere, strong emphasis in Tanzania has been put on self-reliance. Self-reliance comes ahead of economic gain. If you have to choose, you take self-reliance rather than a bigger jump in GNP per capita. Tanzania sees these elements in its own development goals. A reasonably independent economy, that means not heavily dependent on international exchange, on exports and imports, and locally owned. Hertha and I were in Tanzania three years ago this fall. Larry and Nyla are going to be there for a substantial part of a year on sabbatical, looking at Tanzanian economic development and how it relates to the Christian faith. We discovered that there were a lot of things not available in Tanzania which you could buy across the border in Kenya. Kenya is all-out Western-style capitalism. Anything anybody wants and has the money to buy, you can get in Kenya. In Tanzania, that is not true. There are certain things you cannot buy, even if you have the money, because Tanzania's centrally planned economy has decided that they aren't needed for the development of Tanzania. Is that a restriction on freedom? Yes, it is. If you want to get a bottle of scotch and can't buy it, you feel it's a restriction on your freedom. There are many things like that that Tanzania has simply decided it is a foolish waste of international exchange for them to pay import dollars for those items, and so they don't do it. It's one way of trying to remain somewhat independent of the export-import market. Another part of the goal for development in Tanzania is very low reliance on the major powers, either capitalist or socialist, for capital and technical assistance. Tanzania welcomed, after asking the US and Russia to do it, and we both said no, welcomed the Chinese to build a railroad from the coast all the way through Tanzania into Zambia. As soon as the railroad was finished, the Chinese got out. They're gone. They're no longer around. A lot of people thought they would stay and try to influence Tanzania. There's no evidence that they have, or that Tanzania has welcomed their continuing presence. Tanzania wants to develop a fairly egalitarian social structure. That is, the rewards are distributed without big gaps between rich and poor. There is a ceiling on the salary of those who are the best paid, and the gap between the highest and the lowest in the distribution of wages is much less than it is in Kenya or in the United States. It's not a good place to get rich. The major segment of the economy is farmers, who work communally and cooperatively in accord with traditional social patterns in that part of Africa. And urbanizing or industrializing is a low priority. In this definition of development, money is not the base. People and hard work are. There is an interesting emphasis that sounds almost like the Protestant work ethic on work, on the necessity of work and saving and developing capital for the future, which I think is probably not traditional African. In this definition of development, industry is not the base, agriculture is. Not all countries in the poorer part of the planet agree with Tanzania's approach, but this definition does seem to be gaining some support among those who struggle with development strategies and development ethics. Development, then, we could say, this is my attempt at a definition, is a coordinated series of changes, abrupt or gradual, could be revolutionary or evolutionary, a coordinated series of changes, abrupt or gradual, from a phase of life perceived by a population as being less human to a phase perceived as more human. How do you measure? This is going into the third part. How do you measure, then, whether a society is achieving development, whether development is happening, in terms of this kind of definition? What do you use in place of the raw approach of per capita gross national product? Well, there are some people at the Overseas Development Council, which is a U.S.-based, non-profit, non-governmental research and educational organization located in Washington, who have tried to find other ways of measuring progress, performance in development. They looked for ways that could be comparative throughout the whole world. So they had to find data. It had to be quantifiable. They had to find data that was available for every nation in the world. And they came up with a three-part index, which they call the Physical Quality of Life Index. It does not use per capita GNP at all. It uses three other indices. I'm going to pass around copies of a little brochure which describes this approach and why they think it is a more useful tool. I think there are enough here for everyone if each couple takes only one, if you are here as couples. I also have a summary of some of the data on the wall over here on this post. They use three elements, and the three elements are life expectancy, which you can translate into data that can be compared, the average life expectancy at birth of people in a given society this year, which ranges from something like 77 or 75 in Scandinavian countries down to 36 in some of the Central African countries. Infant mortality, which is calculated in terms of deaths per 1,000 births, and literacy rates, which is already a percentage of the population that is literate. Then they take those three figures and blend them into one figure, which becomes the index, the PQLI index for that country. Each of the three getting equal weight, you add them together on a scale from 0 to 100, divide by 3, and that's the result. To go from 0 to 100 on the scales for life expectancy and infant mortality, they took the country which had the best performance in each case and gave it a value of 100. And I think that was Sweden in both of those. They took the country which had the poorest performance and gave it a value of 0 or 1. And then all the others were distributed in between proportionately. They were trying to get at results in a nation's meeting of basic human needs. They looked for a similar figure that would measure health standards. Now, infant mortality and life expectancy are related to that, but coping with illness, disease during a lifetime, they couldn't find some usable set of data. So they went with these three. The results are very interesting because the PQLI for countries within the same gross national product category can vary widely. Thus, countries in the poorest group under 300 per capita GNP, as we usually measure poverty and wealth, that would be the poorest category.
you range from Ethiopia with a physical quality of life index of 16, quite low, to Sri Lanka with an index of 83.
Huh.
Even more interesting, India and Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka is the former Ceylon, side by side, similar cultures in many ways, I think similar religious background, Nehemiah here. Sri Lanka has a slightly lower gross national product per capita, $130 versus $140. But its physical quality of life index, the combination of these three factors, is double that of India, 83 to 41. Now you wonder why. Well, from what I know about the two, Sri Lanka has done a far better job than India of achieving egalitarian distribution of resources, of leveling the gap between rich and poor. So that India is a far better place in which to be rich, if you want to be rich. Sri Lanka is a far better place to be poor, or to be a typical, randomly selected resident. If you had to choose to be born somewhere today, I think you'd choose to be born in Sri Lanka rather than India. Your chances of having basic human needs met would be quite a bit higher. Well, you can run that comparison with other categories too, and I won't go through all of it, but you can look later if you're interested. Much of it is in the brochure as well. With countries in the middle group, 300 to just under 2,000 per capita GNP, Gabon has a $1,960 per capita GNP. Why is that? Why is it so high? Anybody know? It's a country in, isn't it the country where Schweitzer worked in West Africa? Gabon, I think it is. Why is Gabon's GNP so high? It's part of OPEC. It's an oil exporting country. So is Kuwait down here, which has an 11,770 GNP index. But Gabon's physical quality of life index is only 21. Cuba has a GNP of 640. Just moderate, physical quality of life index of 86. Higher than Brazil, which has a higher GNP.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about those two Latin countries, you know that Brazil has a big spread. A lot of quite wealthy people, a sizable middle class, but at least 50% of the population in intense poverty. And they are probably the people who drag down the quality of life index in Brazil. Whereas in Cuba, again, there's a more egalitarian approach. Now, there are certain prices you pay for that, I think, that can't be measured in these data. Elimination of freedoms, restriction on personal pursuits to wealth and other things. But just using these data, you would say Cuba's probably a healthier place to live than Brazil right now. It isn't only socialist societies. Taiwan, which is Western-style capitalism, also has a high physical quality of life index and a relatively low per capita GNP. And then you get into the high-income countries, and you're really talking about the West and OPEC. Kuwait, with a relatively small population and a lot of oil income, has a very high per capita GNP. And so does Libya. But their physical quality of life index is fairly low. And then you get the USA, the UK, and Sweden up close to 100. The USA is not at the top. We do not rank even close to the top on infant mortality. I think we're down around 15th among the Western nations in infant mortality. Well, that maybe enough on that. You can look at the data for yourselves. I don't know if it's in this brochure or another article. They've even done it for states within the U.S. And the District of Columbia ranks lower than Sri Lanka. Larry, sorry about that. You understand it, though, I think. The physical quality of life index for D.C. is lower than that of Sri Lanka.
Last column. That's why our bumper stickers say last column.
Yes, right. So, the happiness of a people, I would conclude, and I hope you would share it, does not depend on an increase or a rise in their gross national product per capita. It may have very little to do with that. It depends on how that increase is distributed.
and to what kinds of basic services it is distributed. Frequently, it appears that gross national product gains are purchased at rather severe social costs, social negatives, including destruction of the extended family, destruction of the traditional rural cooperative work pattern, lowering of nutrition standards. For example, cash crops grown for export instead of subsistence agriculture on the same land to feed people doesn't go through the marketplace. Cash crops will represent an increase in the country's GNP. They may indicate a decrease in the country's nutrition. So just measuring growth in GNP doesn't tell you a whole lot about the nutrition level of a country. Increase in sale of infant formula in a third world country may represent an increase in its GNP. It may represent a decrease in the nutrition of its children, because mother's milk through breastfeeding doesn't get translated into GNP. You don't put a price on that. The point is that development can no longer be understood as the poor nations becoming like us. Perhaps they don't wish to become like us. Perhaps they wish to take some ideas, some technologies, some institutional forms from us in the industrial world and reject others. But finally, the low-income nations are exercising their right to define development for themselves, according to what makes sense to a given culture. And increasingly, the measure is this: the ability to meet basic human needs for all citizens. That's how you measure whether a society is successful or not today. Food, shelter, health care, and education, not just a growing per capita income. Brazil's per capita income has almost doubled in the last, I think, since 1965. But the state of half of the Brazilians is worse off than it was before that increase began, in terms of basic human needs being met. When you think about it, that's not a bad measure of success in any society, rich or poor, whether basic human needs are being met for all of the people. I want to conclude with a quotation from Barbara Ward, whom some of you know of, British Roman Catholic, who is a development ethicist of some renown. One paragraph. She says, "The chief point that distinguishes tribal and traditional European or Western society is that all the internal impulses to modernization have been largely lacking in the traditional societies of the South, the tribal societies. And yet today, these societies are everywhere in a ferment of change. How has this come about? Where did the external stimulus come from? There is only one answer. It came largely uninvited from the restless, changing, rampaging West. In the last 300 years, the world's ancient societies, the great traditional civilizations of the East, together with the pre-Columbian civilizations of Latin America and the tribal societies of Africa, have all, in one way or another, been stirred up from outside by the new, bounding, uncontrollable energies of the Western powers, which during these same years were undergoing concurrently all the revolutions of equality, of nationalism, of rising population, and scientific change, which make up the mutation of modernization. The great worldwide transmitter of the modernizing tendency has been, without doubt, for good and evil, Western colonialism." Okay, we have about 15 minutes. I have 10 o'clock, in which we can discuss these things. Yes,
is there a point at which that quality index is higher than it should be and we should plug in the suicide rate?
Well, that would be an interesting thing to put into it, figures like that, which would maybe try to measure the malaise or the boredom or the distress of a society.
Yeah,
because of course those figures are much higher in the North than in the South,
because
from all that we know.
Health itself isn't everything.
That's right. I think that's the problem with any purely quantifiable measure. You can't pump into this things of the spirit or of spirituality, and I guess you just accept that if you're going to have a quantifiable measurement where you can compare from place to place, you have to use that sort of data, but recognize that it's limited.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some of the things that you said sounded an awful lot like the United States 200, 250, 300 years ago.
And yeah.
Because now these people that we talk about are developing, and as we developed, we had a lot of those same standards, and then mm-hmm. it's kind of like, boom.
Yeah. Did you hear Larry's presentation yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Where he said that one thing that fueled the development of the United States and of Western Europe too, I think, was the attitude towards saving, that you live frugally now, not extravagantly. Your lifestyle is very conservative, conserving, in order to build capital for the future. And that attitude, I think you said, has just about gone away. It's been replaced by a kind of spendthrift, live for today, mm-hmm. frivolous consumption, but that's fairly recent.
But will that happen to those people too?
Well, it varies. It varies a great deal. Tanzania is trying to say to Kenya and to the Kenyas of the world, the only way to develop is to save, to work hard, to build capital for the future and not spend it today on frivolous non-essentials like hard liquor. Whereas in Kenya, anybody who has the money to buy can buy anything the world has to offer. But that's not saving. And a lot of the wealth that is being accumulated in a place like Kenya is spent by the rich on imported products from outside to satisfy their own immediate needs. I think it's true that we are in many of these countries of the third world today where the U.S. and Western Europe were at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
You sounded like Tanzania, and now we're here, and I wondered if they were going
yeah.
to go to.
And I don't think the returns are all in on that yet.
Mm. I think one of the most illuminating things for me anyway in a class on liberation theology this past year was the statement that there's no way that the third world can develop the way we are because they don't have other people,
there's nobody for them to colonize.
To colonize.
Yes,
to
exactly.
Exploit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That really was a big factor in the takeoff of the West,
yeah.
which
yeah.
had the political and economic power at that time. Very little resistance to it. Even in this country, the native population was not much resistance to the incoming European immigration. We just swept them out of the way, killed them off, or pushed them into reserves and took the land and That has happened. Well, in Latin America, you've got an interesting combination of the two. You've got a lot of European immigration, but a larger Indian population that was there, too. And now there's a great deal of intermixing, and then some slave population.
Well, they can exploit us if they gain plutonium and atomic power.
That's one thing that's being talked about, the nuclear blackmail threat.
Yeah.
That some of the third world countries now could already exercise. India presumably could. Heilbronner, in his book, An Inquiry into the Human Prospect, talks about that as one possibility. If the rich North does not agree to systemic change, which lets the poor catch up, one of the scenarios, and Heilbronner thinks it's a very real one, is nuclear terrorism, nuclear blackmail, somewhere in the latter part of this century, perhaps.
That's what it's talking about. It's being done to us.
Yeah, right.
It's interesting you mentioned liberation theology because many of the liberation theologians are fully in favor of the development of nuclear power for their own countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because
for energy use.
Yes, because they want not to be dependent upon our terms for their development. So that we can't say, this is how much energy costs, we'll sell it to you.
Ralph?
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood what was said. I think you were quoting someone about the fact that when the God explosion took place, I think that was the word that was used, people then began to develop as it's happened in the West and now as it's gone to other people. But I'm just wondering about that. Isn't God known everywhere, and doesn't he have a history, maybe not a salvation history, with other nations? And can we say that? You said at the end here, good and evil. Couldn't it be that just the way natural science developed is God's good gift?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, he taught the church to do things even by interpreting the Bible, that these other developments elsewhere, outside of our own Western civilization, could teach us a few things. Can we?
Oh, yeah.
That? It seems yeah. that that was a very, very paternalistic statement. I forget what
yeah.
it was.
Yeah. Ghetto is aware of that problem, and he's, and I may not have given enough attention to it. He says repeatedly that, that there is as much the West or the North has to learn from the values of the traditional societies of the South as they have to gain from the technology and the development understandings of the North. And he would like to see it going both ways. I think there are some evidences that we're starting to, some in the North are starting to learn some of that. A communitarian ethic, for example, as opposed to an individualistic ethic of economic success. But he is rather insistent on the point, and I say, I think this is debatable, the point that the Western fueled, or the fueling of the Western development, which can be traced back to the biblical witness, the Judeo-Christian understanding of God's intervention in history, is unique. Now, he's a Roman Catholic priest who says that that is God's gift to the whole world, and it comes to the whole world through the West. That's his position. And he doesn't say that God is not present in the other cultures, has not left a witness there, but it has been a different kind of revelation. More a view of history that is cyclical or fatalistic, that history is a trap we're in, and we have, like in Buddhism, I guess. Now, I don't know enough about other world religions, just a kind of pop view, but that history and this earth and this realm, this order, is something to be escaped from rather than to be changed.
Yeah, but even in the biblical revelation, I think that God has two types of activities. He has activities in history and events, but he also has activities in just plain blessing, where people
yeah.
simply grow and mature, and that's a very highly neglected thing. We have theology of the recital of God's act in history, and we forget all about the other part, which includes wisdom and maturity. I think that perhaps I think that we phrased in monotheism, I think that's where we've gotten from Judaism and Christianity. And that maybe clears out a lot of idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have so much idolatry left in the West after all these years. And it's just a different form of it. So I guess that's the only thing I've just challenged.
Well, he sees the way it has developed in the West as having a lot of demonic character. The overemphasis on materialism, on acquisitiveness as the end of life rather than a means to, you know, having enough. He does deal with that a great deal. But he also insists that there is something unique and distinctive, which is a gift for the whole world, in the revelation that we understand through the Christian scriptures.
Could you comment on how you think we, Western Christians, develop the so-called, quote, Christian work ethic, because it bothered me. Where did it really come from? Didn't Jesus say, at least at one point, don't worry about tomorrow, today?
Yeah, right.
Today.
Don't be anxious about tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Larry, I wish you'd speak to that. That's more your territory. Were you here yesterday morning?
No, not tomorrow.
Okay.
The work ethic comes out essentially out of the Reformation. And particularly in Calvinism, to a lesser extent in Lutheranism, when there was a shift in the understanding of where your service to God took place, and that shift was away from the sacramental and religious life of the church as to what was really the place of your expression of faithfulness to God, to your everyday workaday life. That's what the Reformation said. You glorify your Creator in your everyday workaday life.
By being a chambermaid or whatever you are, a lawyer.
And then the work ethic developed at the same time that you have the beginnings of the rise of the middle class in North Europe. If this is an age of exploration and the beginnings of trade, and a little later of industry in Great Britain. And there was an extraordinary fit between the admonition to glorify God in your workaday life, but to live a simple life, to live a frugal life, defer material and sensual pleasures, work hard, save, but do not spend. That was reinforced with the middle class and the industrial needs of the time. It fit beautifully. Now later on, after you get the industrial base going, then you have to have people that will spend and consume to keep it going. And when that changes, then you have people who continue to work hard but no longer live simply and frugally. But you ask where it begins. It begins in the combination of the Protestant Reformation and the rise of the middle class, trade, and industrialism. It is not true, and it's since become true of wherever industrialism has spread. It's not true of Christianity as a whole, and it's not true of the New Testament. Although there are elements in the biblical materials, there are elements which Paul says, you know, if you don't work, you don't eat.
You shouldn't eat.
But actually, Christ himself really didn't point in that direction.
No.
Maybe put a lot of humanistic elements in the religion and develop that way ourselves.
Back here.
I'm fascinated with your presentation this morning and the strong appeals to the primitivism, I guess you might call it. Particularly drawn towards your remarks on Tanzania. Manage the economy, manage lives of people, which would be discouraging of individual freedoms. The matter of elites prescribing for others what should be done. And there's a basic puzzle in my mind. If the Christianity is responsible for the mess of the Western world we are today, what are the conflicts now that you have seen in Tanzania of the Christian church right now?
Well, that's a very...
In other words, what are they doing right now? This subversion from within.
It's a very interesting approach. Many see in the Tanzanian founding documents a great deal of Christianity.
Yeah.
And Julius Nyerere is a not just a nominal or a token Roman Catholic, but a practicing, faithful, theologically oriented Roman Catholic. His writings reveal that. So I don't really know that, and I'm sure the church there, from everything I've read and know, and I have a brother who's worked there 5 years in the church. The Lutheran Church of Tanzania is the largest Protestant church. The Roman Catholic is the largest church, period. The church there, in all of its public expressions, and I think in all of its private expressions too, says it's fully in support of the Tanzanian experiment. It is not like it's under siege or under pressure. It is not a non-theist society. In the public schools of, this is just a symptom, but in the public schools of Dar es Salaam, the secondary schools, every student must take a religion, must take courses in religion, Muslim, Protestant, or Catholic. So it is not an anti-religion state or an anti-theist state at all.
Essentially, your hypothesis that from the various authorities you've been citing, that the Judeo-Christian ethic is responsible for the catastrophe of the Western world. There are no evidences of any tension, anything in the making, whereby it's going to do the same thing to Tanzania.
Well, I said it's good and bad. It's not a catastrophe unmixed. It is both good and bad. I believe that, and I think the author of this book does, and Barbara Ward does. I think, well, Larry has been looking at Tanzania also because he's going to spend some time living there.
Now let me make a comment, though, because Ralph raised it earlier. The contention was not that the Judeo-Christian ethic is responsible for the mess. I think Ghetto states it's a little too strongly, and I will look in reading the book to see if there are some nuances. The point was, there are elements in the Western appropriation of particular notions from the biblical tradition that interact with other things. A view of history interacts with some of the things in industrialization. The ancient Hebrews don't have a nature-history split in their frame of mind. We do.
Part of that
is traceable to the Western developments. Now, you can't simply locate it with the biblical materials themselves, because that doesn't explain why you get this drive to change all of nature and society. It isn't there. There are some things which you can take from there, and when they interact with the growth of technology, which amplifies human powers, then you get a result. It's a complex cultural interaction of various factors, some of which have their roots in the biblical materials.
That's
a very different thing than saying the Judeo-Christian ethic
comes out
here. It's you know, a couple thousand years of interacting factors. And so that's why other peoples, like Tanzanians, who have now through the colonial process also received those biblical materials, read a lot of them differently, because they read them through other cultural lenses,
and they
see other elements.
But in other words, my essentially, I come back to the question, which is a bad phrase. These cultural elements.
Yeah.
In other words, are misreadings, or are, shall we say, poor phrasing of the Judeo-Christian ethic. The crumbs are on the edges. Where are they in Tanzania? Can we codify them? Maybe not yet.
Well, I might mention my own minister's visit to rural council churches in Switzerland this spring, and he was very moved by a Presbyterian Tanzania, and this man was very dynamic, and he said their people don't want to develop the same way we've developed.
Mm-hmm.
If they build a windmill, they want to be able to repair it themselves rather than to order a machine metal gear from the United States.
Yeah, yeah. I should have mentioned that, I think. That whole attitude toward a technology which is intermediate or appropriate and which is supportive of human labor intensive ways of doing things, rather than throwing people out of work, replacing them with machines and with petrol or petroleum. That's a keynote throughout most of the third world. They've got people, and the goal is to develop in a way that keeps people occupied and employed, rather than, as they see in the West in latter stages, where the goal is labor saving, to farm and do everything else in a way that doesn't use many people but uses a lot of machines and chemicals. So that's an important element too, I think. Okay?
I think everybody that attended the OWF assembly last summer in Dar es Salaam was impressed by the growth of the economy and the growth of life in Tanzania. Nobody would question that at all, even from the surface impression you get from 2 or 3 weeks spent there, and the life of the church.
Did you feel the church was in harmony with the policy goals of the society?
Definitely.
Yeah, I do too.
And very much a part of the picture of the development of Tanzania. However, no development is perfect.
Yes, that's right.
For instance, the communal farm system, the bringing of the farmers from their own little locales into the villages.
Yeah, Ujamaa.
Often that was done by force.
That's right.
And their places were simply wiped out
and
moved by force. And likewise, China, is not as...
And Cuba, you'd have to say.
They have something to say yet, because at the assembly, two nations were not allowed to send delegates. They were on their way, but they were stopped in Switzerland, Taiwan and South Korea.
Yeah,
and you can't help but think, that somebody beside Nairobi made that kind of decision.
Some political ideology entered in to that. Yeah.
So you get a mixed bag, no matter what kind of.
But the mix counts. Which mix it is, it matters immensely.
I see two more hands. The bell has rung. Can we do it very quickly? Your comments.
Unless we can let people
go. We're overlooking something. Is in any society, in any country in the world, 10% of the people run the program. And this is true in the United States, it's true in Tanzania, it's true in Russia, it's true in China. Any place you look, the intelligence is gathered probably in the real hardcore intelligence is gathered probably in about 10% of the population. It's true there, 10% of the people run China. 10% of the people in the United States. From the United States, it's true in Tanzania, and people forget. I don't care what you say or how you do it, that 10% is going to run your life and mine.
One more.
Okay, yeah, the things that are being said in terms of the rich nations advancing at the expense of the poor. I personally hold to that, but I'm really curious as to what are those, what is being said by those that refute that hypothesis.
Can we hold that till tomorrow? Because that's really the subject matter for tomorrow. Today was internal factors, tomorrow's external factors.
Yeah,
it's a great lead-in.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow.